This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack, but with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Good afternoon and welcome to Haystack Help Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today. Hey, it's that day we call Your Money Matters, brought to you by Affordable Interest Mortgage. Mr. Kurt Rogers joins us. Before we get to our extra special guest today, Kurt, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
I'm doing well, man.
First full day of spring.
Beautiful.
I mean,
it's
really,
awesome.
This Colorado, this
for
is
now.
Beautiful. For now.
But, you never know.
But Saturday, Sunday, yep. Like 40, rain, snow. That's actually pretty good for us. It's
absolutely
springtime. We're supposed to get that moisture.
We need it.
The water is better than the snow.
Yeah, for sure.
Because then it's cold.
It is. Yes, sir. Well, again, we got a great show in store for you, and no stranger to our airways, but attorney Kevin Flesh is with us. So, Kevin, we'll say hello.
Why, hello.
Hello, man.
This is wild.
It's not Thursday. It's not legal talk. It's Tuesday.
Exactly.
Kevin, you know this is radio. You don't have to wear a suit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I really dressed up for the occasion.
Yeah,
but, you
did, man.
Tie and the whole thing, running around. You guys had to go out into the parking lot looking for me just a couple minutes before the show because I'm not don't always do a live show. So
thought you were lost.
Huh? Yeah, well, I'm definitely lost. But yeah, I was in Jefferson County this morning and the courthouse was crazy busy. So, wow. But I made it here. We're here and happy to talk about what we do. And it's good to see you, Kurt.
It's nice to see you again. Last time we talked was Christmas.
I think it was.
We do that
the
little
Christmas
show.
Special. Yeah,
talked about all those things we remember when we were kids.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
Reminisce.
Y'all could think back that far?
I had to write it down.
Yeah, really?
Right. We had it recorded on cassettes and
yeah,
other
exactly.
VHS
old video.
Tapes.
Old Super 8.
Yeah. Super 8.
I have some of that.
Yes.
Well, we are going to get into a lot of stuff here with Kevin, but Kurt, real quick, let's talk about rates real quick on your end of things. Fed's raising rates a quarter or not?
I firmly believe that they'll raise them a quarter. There was at one point talk that they were going to raise them a half, but with the little bank fiasco that we had, you know, 10 days ago, they decided that's probably not a good idea. That's pushing them over the cliff too much. I also think that if they don't raise them, it sends the wrong signal. Now, we could talk for a long time about what they're doing and how they're fixing the problems with the bank. I don't think that the rates going up a quarter, you're going to see much impact across the board. You're not going to see it in the mortgages. Actually, our rates over the last week have come down pretty substantially. They were cracking 7. Now they're getting back down into the low to mid 6s. So it's kind of beneficial. But I don't think they'll raise them the next period.
Okay.
I think they'll just stay the way they are until everything kind of settles a little bit. See what unemployment does, how inflation's going.
All right. Interesting times.
Yeah, it's something you kind of have to pay attention to. We're seeing there's a lot more activity. Housing starts were up 12% February. Mortgage applications were up 10.6%. So people are starting to get back into it. There's still a high demand. We have less than a 40-day supply of homes. So they're still going. There's still bidding wars in some areas. There's still people paying over asking price and overappraised price. I had that happen on a lady the other day. She paid $80,000 over what it appraised for. Right. She wanted the house.
Yeah, we just had that in our neighborhood as well. A couple of houses went up for sale. One of them, they were just my friends that are neighbors. They were like, "We're just going to test the market," and then they got into this bidding war with 3 or 4 different people, and they sold the darn thing. They don't know where they're going to go because now they have to go look for a house.
If it's a nice house, it's going to sell, and it's going to sell for all the money.
Yeah.
If it needs what I call a little TLC, okay, that's something you can start negotiating on.
Yeah.
And that market's going to stay that way for a while.
Sure. Affordable Interest Mortgage, your one-stop shop for all of your mortgage needs. 720-895-0500 is the number.
You know, Kurt, that product that you helped me with
a few years ago. The asset manager.
Yeah, the asset manager. That loan has performed just ridiculously because it's on a different rate structure.
It's a simple interest.
Yeah.
And because of that, your payment adjusts downward as the payoff goes down, and you save less interest.
Well, not only that, but just the interest that you are.
Yes.
I mean, that interest rate has stayed pretty good. Because it's on is it the LIBOR that
it's? The one you have is tied to LIBOR. The new ones are tied to the T-bills. And they're actually, with rates going down, they're actually gone down considerably in the last 10 days.
Yeah, and I keep telling people about that mortgage and the product that it is, because it's fantastic, especially if you're in a small business or you're in a situation where you have some cash flow coming in.
You got money extra times coming in. You can really make it, takes all your lazy money and puts it to work.
It really does.
Instantly.
Yeah.
I just found out today, and not to pat myself on the back, they just told me I'm third in the country in that product, in the wholesale.
Wow.
And I'm like, wow.
That's awesome. The other thing that I can say is the North Point Bank, the folks that service that loan, they're really good too. Yeah. And so an extra little plug for you, because that was something that, I mean, we entered into that. We had our first mortgage on our house completely paid off, and I used that product to basically have cash on hand to buy a second home in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And if we hadn't had that, we wouldn't have been able to buy the house that we eventually did.
A lady the other day, she sent me pictures of a townhome she bought in Hawaii. She said, thanks, Kurt, for this loan. I was able to get my dream property in Hawaii.
Wow.
That's exactly right. So awesome product. And like you said, you mean it's great because you are able to pay it down. And you have it for, I think, what is it, a 30-year term.
30-year term.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you pay it off much faster.
Yes.
Yep. Once again, 720-895-0500 is the number for Kurt. And, hey, he'll be glad to help and take a look at your situation and see what's good for you there as well.
First time I've had you on my show. You have to say this more to me than to other people. You're a personal injury attorney.
So, yes, we do a lot of personal injury work. I'm actually a litigator.
Okay.
I do trial work. And I do trial work primarily in two areas of practice. Personal injury, so car accidents, premises liability, slip and falls, any sort of negligence cases that you're bringing against someone. Someone's caused you injury because of a tort or because they've done something to you. We handle those sorts of civil cases. I also do a tremendous amount of criminal defense work as well. And the reason that we do that work is because it keeps our trial skills fresh, and it's interesting work as well. So yeah, those are the two aspects. We primarily, on our show on Thursdays, talk about personal injury work, but we also do a lot of criminal defense work. And for example, I have two associates that work almost full-time being public defenders in several municipalities around the metro area.
Yeah, Scott was telling me that you offer your services to do that in different areas.
Yep.
So when somebody says if you can't afford an attorney, they could get you.
Right. And yeah, they could. And let's say if you qualify in Thornton or Longmont or Wheat Ridge or Lakewood, all of those, I'm the public defender for those municipalities. And then when somebody gets qualified economically to have a public defender appointed, I could show up.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
Hey, be sure you can catch Kevin now. Kevin's on a couple of our stations, all right? Hey, he's on Legal Talk here every Thursday from noon to 12:30 here on KLZ 560, and then Saturdays 10:30 to 11 on our sister station, 810 Legends and 95.3, and you can catch Kevin there as well.
But the personal injury practice, that's what most people hear about us, relating to helping people with injury cases.
Somebody slip and fall, gets in a car accident.
Yep.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, so, you know, especially where we help people is when those sorts of things happen and they don't know what to do with regard to all of the intricacies relating to car accidents in particular. You know, who's going to pay for all of my medical expenses? How is that going to happen? And the procedure, because there's just so many different coverages. Does your own med pay? Does your health insurance? You know, if you don't have health insurance, is there a potential to have somebody treat you on a lien? We have doctors that will do that, and then they get paid when we get the case resolved. And then also just dealing with the underinsured, uninsured motorist claims. There's just a lot of insurance questions that people have that we help people with.
So you're more of a litigator in that area.
Yes.
So you don't have a problem going to trial with some of these insurance companies?
No, I don't.
You're not intimidated.
They have a problem with him coming to trial. You don't have a problem with him.
They'd rather negotiate with you than take you to trial.
They would, because they know that I'm going to go to trial if they don't make an offer that we deem to be fair.
Well, I just did a quick check on that, and your success ratio in trial is three times as much monetarily as it is if you negotiate.
You know, it all depends on the case.
Yeah,
a lot of times
it is.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, it's interesting because jurors in Colorado are still pretty conservative.
Yes.
We're not California, we're not Texas, we're not
yet.
Florida. Yet. Right. But and that may change over time based upon sort of the demographics. From the standpoint of what I do on a regular basis, I'd love to see those jury verdicts higher because it would mean that my settlement the settlement amounts could go up. But that's not what we've necessarily seen over the last 25 years, that they've been pretty steady. But there's certainly cases. Just I just had a settlement conference on Friday where we're fighting with my client's actual insurance company, and it's the largest insurance company in the U.S., State Farm. And sometimes the way that they handle their claims is just really difficult, and they almost force you into a trial. And that's what I think will end up happening in this case, because I think at trial we'll be able to prove their claims practices are incorrect in this particular case, and a jury will agree with us. But we'll just have to wait and see, because sometimes as you get closer to trial,
They'll bail.
And they say, okay, we'll give you what you want because we really don't want to take that risk.
Yeah, we don't want to keep going forward because we think we'll lose anyhow.
Well, you know, it's but insurance companies, you know, they have the ability to make those decisions. And a lot of them will do that on an annual basis where, you know, for whatever reason, in the fall of last year, for example, I'm sure almost every insurance company, sort of the management team of that insurance company got together and said, how was our claims experience this year? And what do we think we can work on in making that claims experience less for our shareholders and for us so that we can be more profitable?
Right.
And so what they do on an annual basis is they kind of look at things and try to tweak some of their claims processes so that they can pay less in claims that next year. So what it means is that sometimes they get obstinate about what they're going to pay. And then we have to try some cases to prove them wrong. And then they change their practices the following year.
Yeah.
And we see that all the time. But there's also some insurance companies that historically have just been difficult claims folks, that they don't generally offer fair amounts in their claims.
But just because a case went a certain way in this scenario doesn't mean the next time it comes up, it's going to go that same way.
It's not. But remember, on my end of the practice, you know, I may get that opportunity of that same claim once every couple of years. And maybe I change my tactics. The insurance company may have one of those claims every 30 days.
But it's a different litigator.
Right. It's a different litigator.
And they don't know.
Correct. And so that's very true, that they then will rely on their local claims folks to say, and the defense lawyer to say, hey, what's this plaintiff's lawyer like? And what has been how have they done historically with jurors? And you get a reputation for that over time. And we certainly have that reputation to go to trial, because we do. And that's a fun. So trials are fun for me, actually being involved in the trial, you know, picking a jury, get to talk to jurors.
Keeps you sharp.
It does. It also keeps you grounded and humble, because there are times where you think you've got a trial wired and something goes sideways on you. And it can be a witness that testifies. I was in trial yesterday, and my client, really nice guy, but not a very good witness. So I thought I had prepped him really well for his testimony, and then he would get up on the stand, and I'd be like, okay, we talked about this. This should go well. And he just sort of fumbled through what we had talked about that was really important to his case. And it turned out that, well, I don't have the verdict yet on it. It was a court trial, so we're waiting for a judge to come back and tell us. But when I was listening to his testimony, I was like, you know, you're not being nearly as compelling as you were sitting in my office.
Yeah.
And sometimes that happens.
It can be intimidating, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, completely. But, you know, we work on that with our witnesses and with our clients, not telling them what to say, but, you know, getting them prepared so that they understand.
The questions that come and maybe the intensity of the question.
Right.
And how they'll say, ask a couple at a time, that kind of throw you off.
Right. And sort of what. The other thing that's really important in the preparation is the education for the witness. So the witness understands their part in the puzzle that you're creating, in the picture that you're creating, and what piece is their testimony important for? Because a lot of people don't really get that concept. They just think, well, I go in, tell the truth, and it'll be fine.
Yeah, it's that simple.
It's that simple, but no. It's not, because you're really, I mean, it's like any other story. Like, you know, you've seen good movies and you've seen movies that you're like, oh, that wasn't that great. The stories may be similar, but the way that they tell the story is compelling, in different points of time. And so that's where I think experienced trial lawyers realize how important it is to, not theatrics, but certainly to be, to tell the story in a way that's effective to explain what you want to explain.
Correct.
Yeah.
Attorney Kevin Flesh is with us. It is Flesh and Beck Law. Once again, you can hear Kevin here every Thursday for our regular time during Haystack from noon to 12:30 on KLZ, and also his show is on our sister station 810 and 95.3 on Saturdays 10:30 to 11. You know, we do these shows. We've been doing these shows as long as, you know, Kurt and I have been doing these shows, so we've talked about this a million times. But again, maybe a new audience today, different day that we're on, but is one of the most difficult parts of the whole personal injury side is just when we talk about the insurance side, is just when there's not insurance money there. So talk about that a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. So the worst cases that we have is where you have a client that comes in, significant injuries, and it turns out that the person that hit them has, you know, the minimum limits, which is $25,000 in Colorado, of bodily injury coverage, and then they've declined any underinsured, uninsured motorist coverage. You know, a lot of people don't realize that in Colorado, as one of the bases in which we can create value in a personal injury case is related to the health benefits and what you have for medical expenses. Well, if you are in a substantial accident and you have a head injury, for example, you're going to go to the ER and have a bunch of scans, so CT scan or MRI or those sorts of things, and then a lot of care to figure out what exactly is going on with you initially. Well, that emergency room visit may be $30,000 or $40,000 billed. And if somebody has a $25,000 policy, you've just burned through that. And if you don't have those other coverages, especially uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage, you're kind of limited in what you can do in a recovery unless you can find the person that has those minimum limits that has significant assets besides. And so that's really what a lot of times what we talk about in the show, and in sort of thinking about your own life and what's important, is making sure that you have insurance coverages that cover you in case of these sorts of accidents, and that you can afford those coverages so that you have them when the worst thing happens and somebody else hits you.
Well, mainly in my mind, say, okay, let's say I've got some money over here in retirement. I've got some assets.
Yeah.
But I have very cheap insurance that's going to give me the 25.
Yeah.
If there ain't enough there, you're coming after this.
That's correct.
So it'd be better for me to raise this
up
than you get this pile over here.
Yeah, and we regularly do asset. Yep.
Buying this insurance for maybe $1 million or $500,000 is going to save my $500,000 over here.
That's exactly right.
I mean, as you said that, I'm like, well, that's a simple decision.
Yeah, and most people that have those sorts of assets think about those things. But what they don't think about is, okay, I'm covering, I'm making sure that when I'm liable for something, when I cause bodily injury, I want to make sure that I have enough to cover my assets that I have now for the person that I've hurt. But what I'm also talking about is making sure that your underinsured, uninsured limits are high enough, because those are limits for you, and so that you don't have to dip into that retirement savings early, or you don't have to maybe do some of the disability payments or other things that may or may not be in your quiver of financial products that you have, that you're able to go to that to get you made whole in the event that you get hit by somebody that either doesn't have insurance, because there's a lot of folks in Colorado that don't, or have the minimum limits.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was looking at some stats just from 2022, and, again, I guess Google says it is true, but it said there's reported about 220 accidents a day in the Denver region is what this stat said, okay?
And 220
so,
a day.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that's reported.
You wonder why there's so many billboards for lawyers.
Exactly.
That's not counting those parking lot accidents where you catch somebody and swap the cars.
Right.
Yeah. So if you get, you know, 30% of the people that don't have insurance, 30% of the people that are underinsured.
Right.
So you got maybe a 35-40% chance of coming out all right.
Right.
You know, which those odds aren't very good. And you can control that, though.
Correct.
By having your own good insurance.
Yep. Yeah. And the underinsured, uninsured motorist coverage is an expensive coverage. It's not like the...
It's pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, it really is. And that's really what, whenever I talk to people, they're like, well, what should I be concerned about? I'm like, you know, get whatever limits you need for liability, considering what assets you have to protect those. But then make sure you you put as much money as you can into the underinsured, uninsured motorist coverage.
I think a lot of people think that if I have insurance and the insurance I'm covered, I'm not liable for the rest of this. And all this other stuff I have is protected.
Right, and that's not the case. Exactly. Yeah, I have a really interesting case right now where I've a long, tangled story, but I've represented this family and a couple of the kids in the family for decades, and they've both had their issues criminally, and one of them is in the Department of Corrections. And just before being sent to prison, he was in a car accident and caused an accident, and he had minimum limits, and so he's being sued while he's in the penitentiary, and then while he was in prison, his grandfather died and left him a couple hundred thousand dollars. And now all of a sudden he's got this asset that may be at risk. And so we're trying to figure out a way to shield that asset from creditors down the road. Now, luckily, we've talked with his insurance company, and his insurance company is willing to tender their limits or more to make it go away. But the plaintiff's lawyer is looking at it, and they don't know about the asset yet, but they haven't accepted those limits yet. So you don't know exactly what's going to happen in these sorts of situations. Mm-hmm. And so that's why when people are looking at their insurance and making some buying decisions, much like your business, Kurt, yep, you don't go on the internet and just deal with it yourself. You got to talk to a human being about it, right?
Yeah, there's so many things. And you need to shop.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of salespeople don't want you to shop. I want you to shop because you start to see the total picture of what's out there.
That's right.
And where the real cost is.
Yeah.
You know, the rate may be low, but the APR side, well, where are they hiding the money?
Right.
And that happens in a lot of different
places.
And
what are the fees and what are the things that you're going to have to pay for?
Where are they doing it?
And in the back end, you know, what happens? Is there any cost for me paying this off early or, you know, prepayment penalties or anything like that or any ways to get out of it? And it's the same way with insurance. The thing that people think, unfortunately, because I have this conversation almost weekly with clients of mine that have had an insurance company that they've had the same insurance for decades. And they're like, well, I've had this insurance for decades. The insurance company should really care about that. The insurance companies don't care.
They don't care. They clear you out at the end of the year.
Yeah. You're a new customer every year to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I learned that from my agent. At the end of the year, you're cleared out.
Yeah.
Okay. We made money on him this year. Or are we going to do it again next year?
Right.
That's pretty much how
they
look at it.
And they're looking at that analysis every year.
It's about the money.
And if you have a loss that's a substantial loss, they will drop you without any trouble.
Oh, all day long.
Yeah.
Yeah. File two claims on your roof.
Right.
Say goodbye.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Again, Attorney Kevin Flesh is our guest. Once again, catch Kevin here on Thursdays, noon to 12:30 on KLZ 560, and also on Saturdays from 10:30 to 11 for Legal Talk on our sister station 810 and 95.3. Now, when you go after you do the asset search, and they have a home, they have this and that. What are you doing at that? Are you putting liens on things, or I mean, you can't force them to sell?
No, you can't. Yeah. No. I used to do bankruptcy work prior to the law changing in 2003. And so I'm still familiar with sort of the things that people can do to hide their assets.
Gotcha.
Relating to exemptions and other things. So a lot of times if we get into a situation where we do believe that we have an individual that has assets that we can attach to, so the first thing is in Colorado, you sue the individual as the tortfeasor. You don't sue their insurance company. So Scott, you hit me. I'm saying that you're at fault for my injuries. I'm going to sue you. And even though your insurance company is going to defend you, the lawsuit is always going to be in your name. And so the insurance company has a duty to defend you, and they have a duty to pay their policy limits relating to your claim if I'm able to get a judgment.
Right.
And so the idea is, in the event that I do get a judgment and I've put the insurance company in a bind in the sense that I've given them a demand to tender the limits and they don't do that, then they have to pay whatever the judgment is from the jury. Okay, so then we tie your insurance company basically through you. But if that doesn't happen, like in the case where I was just talking about where the insurance company has tendered their limits and the plaintiff hasn't accepted it, and I've had those situations where I had a defendant that had significant assets had caused significant injuries to my client, we will proceed to trial, and then we would get a judgment against that person, and then we would chase them for the money. We could put a lien on their house. depending upon, we've had this situation where there may be very little amounts in the way of a first or a second mortgage, we could foreclose on that lien, and then we could get the house. They would then have an exemption under state law and federal law relating to the certain amounts that they would be entitled to keep as equity from that house, but we could eventually force a sale of that house. There's also normally other assets that aren't exempt, regular non-retirement accounts, brokerage accounts, things, okay. Cash,
right.
Other assets, maybe the person has
gold.
Multiple gold,
Bitcoin,
cars,
stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, all of those things that don't fall under exemptions, we would be able to attach to and get through the legal process after we have a judgment.
Right.
And the judgment, quite frankly, is the easy part a lot of times in these cases. You get a judgment, and then you've got to chase them. I've got a judgment for $14 million that I've had for 15 years, and the guy just got out of prison relating to an economic crime. And so now we're going to try to chase him for it. I don't know if we're ever going to get any money from it. So, you see sometimes the advertisement by lawyers where we've gotten all of these judgments for all of this money. The real question is, what have you collected yeah. relating to those judgments?
Yeah. How do we get paid?
Right.
Right.
You know, when something like that happens, there is a liability if you are convicted of bad decisions in
yep.
that car accident. You've got to pay for it.
Right.
It's not like you're out of line for it because somebody over here is suffering.
Correct. To a point. I mean, our federal bankruptcy laws, unfortunately, for your average car accident, you can, as a defendant, get out of paying for those damages.
With a bankruptcy,
except for the limits relating to your liability insurance.
Correct.
Yep. And, in fact, I had an interesting case this fall. Started out as a criminal case, was representing this woman, and she alleged all the way through that the individual who was making the allegations against her did so not because of some criminal allegation, but something else, that they were trying to get back at her and were vindictive in the manner in which they called the police and did all this. We got the case dismissed, a criminal case dismissed, and then we sued the individual civilly, saying that they used the legal process improperly. And we ended up getting a judgment for about $12,000, which was great. And then I started chasing the guy to pay that money, and he filed bankruptcy last week.
Done.
Yeah. And she won't get that money back. But we went through that whole process to try to force him to do it. He was in a financial position where he didn't have any assets and had other debts, and so then he filed bankruptcy. So we're still going to litigate it a little bit in bankruptcy yeah. court just to see if we can get it as a dischargeable debt, but most likely the federal law relating to dischargeability of debts is going to force us to stop yeah. our collection efforts.
Right.
But it's a pretty interesting process.
Yeah, no doubt. You're listening to a special edition of Your Money Matters and Legal Talk with attorney Kevin Flesh. It's Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886. We'll be right back.
Here's why you need personal injury attorney Kevin Flesh on your side. He understands the way the jury thinks. In the context of a personal injury case, you have been hurt by someone else's negligence. The idea is that you're going to try to recover so that you can get back to where you were just prior to that incident occurring. What that really means from a jurist's perspective is that you're going to be asking them to award you money. So when we talk about fairness, we're talking about six people that you don't know. Those six people hear evidence and make a unanimous decision that will decide what the fair value is. When you're the one that's hurt, you have a good idea what you think it's worth. The question is, can you persuade those other individuals, whom you don't know and weren't witnesses, to believe that's what the case is worth? Kevin Flesh understands the way the jury thinks. Call now for a free consultation, 303-806-8886. Flesh and Beck Law. They get results.
The Outdoorsman's Attic is Colorado's very own outdoor gear consignment store. From live bait to lanterns, firearms to ammo, packs to sleeping bags, all the fishing gear you could ever hope for. And if you need some decoys for the waterfowl season, stop into the Outdoorsman's Attic. Hey, this is Scott Watley here again for my friends at the Outdoorsman's Attic, and they've got hunting, fishing, and camping gear with huge savings up to 70%. You'll find new and pre-owned items to choose from, and since the inventory changes daily, hey, this is a store you need to stop in at least a couple of times a week. Reviews, Here's what a few of their customers have said. Cody says, hey, two floors of pure outdoorsman paradise. Mickey said, I love this place. Great small business, family owned and run, lots to look at and good prices. Amy says, if you need good camping and outdoor gear, go here first. Support a local small business. Such great finds. Everyone is so nice and helpful. So save big. Get to the Outdoorsman's Attic today on all of your outdoor gear. 2650 West Hampden Avenue in Sheridan. Tell them Scott sent you.
With everyone wanting more of your money, from eggs to gas to taxes, how do you keep more of what you've earned? Call 720-895-0500, Affordable Interest Mortgage, where we can show you how to pay less interest on your home, have access to your equity for 30 years, and be prepared for unexpected expenses or emergencies. The market has changed. You now have more buying authority, whether you want to purchase with a rate in the threes on a 3-2-1 buy-down, or refinance and pay less interest to own your home faster with the Asset Manager Mortgage. Call Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500, where we've been serving Coloradans for over 20 years. Government agencies continue to raise the cost of financing, whether to purchase or refinance. Let us show you how not to pay these increased fees with loan programs designed to pay less interest and put you in control of your equity. If you want to purchase a home with the rates in the threes, or you want to have access to your equity, call Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. In these difficult times, you can still save. 720-895-0500. That's 720-895-0500. And MLS 298-191, regulated by DOR.
Rush to Reason with John Rush, weekdays from 3 to 7 on KLZ 560.
Welcome to a special edition of Legal Talk, brought to you by Affordable Interest Mortgage and Your Money Matters. And great to have Kevin Flesh with us once again in studio. And normally Kevin is on different days with us here, but you can catch him normally on Thursdays, noon to 12:30 here on KLZ, and then on our sister station on Saturdays, 10:30 to 11 on 810 and 95.3 for Legal Talk there as well.
Okay, I have a question that I've been waiting to get to this time to ask you about. When you're stopped, whether you think you're right or wrong,
yeah,
there are certain things, and there's kind of two different areas I want to talk about. But if I'm stopped in a traffic violation, what in the state of Colorado, because every state's different, can I not do, should do, shouldn't do?
Yeah. So, first of all, the traffic, you're just standard garden variety traffic stop for a police officer is one of the most dangerous situations that the police officer can be in. For them. Completely. If you look at the statistics relating to police fatalities and injuries of officers, it's almost always the top of the list is relating to traffic stops. So you have to think about their psyche when they're coming to your door. I mean, I'm being truthful.
I understand.
Right. So one of the things that you want to do is you want to put them at a little bit at ease relating to the fact that you understand the process in the sense that they are in control of what's going on. They have the right to pull you over. You can argue with them whether they do or not in court, but at the moment that they're standing next to you at your door, they are in control of the transaction. They just are, right? So the idea is that you want to do it as quickly as possible, as efficiently as possible, and to make sure that they feel as comfortable as they can. So some of the things that I suggest is when you get pulled over, try to get over to the right-hand side and off to the shoulder or into a parking lot or something as quickly as possible so that you don't frustrate them, like they think that you don't see their strobe lights and their sirens and everything else going on. Get over as fast as, because I mean, that happens where people just drive on and they have training experience to say that you're doing that. You could be eluding, you could be fleeing, and there could be other charges because
changes everything.
Changes everything. Correct. So get over as quickly as possible. And then when the officer is getting out of their car and coming up to you, you want to make sure that they can see your hands and that you're not fumbling around, digging around in your car like you may be grabbing a gun, because that happens. You want to have the ability for them to see your hands. Put them on the steering wheel. Just wait for them to come to you and ask you questions. You don't know at that point why they're pulling you over, right? You have no idea. And you don't want to presume, because you were doing 25 miles over the speed limit, that they're pulling you over for speeding.
Well, they're going to ask you that question.
They
you
are
know
gonna.
What you were doing.
Yes.
That's one of the first things out of their mouths.
About sounds 90. About 90. That's usually my
was I speeding? I mean, I have a couple neighbors, and that's the first question to the cops. That's the first question to ask.
Yes.
You know what you were doing?
Yes. And you know why they're doing that, right? Because especially now in the world that we live in with body cameras, your response may be an admission of guilt, and you're not under in custody.
Yeah,
at that
you mean
moment.
I read that light?
Right, exactly. You mean the fact that I'm 15 over, or I'm assuming you're pulling me over because I didn't stop exactly at that stop sign?
Done.
That's that sort of thing, and it helps them, you know, throughout the litigation process on the citation that they're going to give you. So when they ask you that question, you don't have any obligation to say anything. Or if you want to say, I have no idea why you pulled me over, you know, or you can say, I'm not going to answer that question. That's a legitimate way to respond. And you're not being a jerk about it. You can say, listen, I listened to this lawyer show and he says, I don't have to answer that question.
Or a simple no. Do you know why
no.
I put, no,
yeah,
I don't.
No, I have no idea. Yep. Right. So then, and then you wait to see what they have to say. You know, you don't immediately pull out your phone and start taping them. Because most likely in Colorado now, because the legislature 2 years ago, or almost 3 years ago, entered legislation that by now, all police agencies have to have body camera footage. And if they don't have body cameras, then any interaction that they have with the public is presumed not to have happened. Think about that.
Presumed not to have happened.
It's not going to be allowed in court. So if they don't have body cameras on their body taking down what they're saying and what's going on, they probably aren't going to have a case. So you don't have to whip out your phone and start going down that road. You can if you want, but it's going to frustrate the process.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. So that's they ask you that question. We've gotten through that question. You say no, or you say whatever you want. Then they're going to ask you for your license and registration.
Mm-hmm. And insurance.
Yep, and insurance. And you're going to ask them if it's not readily available, and we've had...
I tell you, when he said fumbling around while ago in the car, that's usually what people are looking for.
The minute they're stopped, they're looking for it.
You're reaching way over in the glove compartment to try to get it. And Kevin had this really cool deal. I may have an extra. I'll get you one. But it's just a little plastic sleeve I keep above my visor.
Yep.
And it's got all that in there, except my license.
I have the same thing.
You see what I mean?
Yep. It's right here.
Yep. You look like you've got everything together. Okay, and you look organized, and man, just boom.
That or you've been stopped a whole lot, so you just don't like going.
Trust me, I know right where mine is.
Well, one of the other things that police officers do in their training is that's one of the things that, especially in DUI stops, if you're fumbling around and you give them your MasterCard when you think you're giving them your license, or you're giving them, you know, your Costco card, or you're giving them something else that doesn't relate to what they're asking for, they'll put that in the report, and it'll be an indication that you're impaired.
Yeah, give them a receipt of something that's supposed to be your homeowner's insurance.
That's right.
Medical. Well.
Exactly. So, but the idea then is, you know, to make sure however comfortable they are, say, can I do this, can I do that, wherever it is, it'd be great. And I need to make some more of those and have those available. Because those are nice. What you want to do is prior to being stopped, you want to have all of that stuff organized so you can just pull it out and give them the proof of insurance. Or if you have the proof of insurance on your phone, you can ask them to open up your phone and show them that. And they'll accept that these days. So license, insurance, and registration. So if you give those three things to them, they'll go back to their car and do whatever they're going to do. They may give you a warning. They may give you a citation. But while you're sitting there, again, just make sure that they're comfortable with what you're doing. Don't get out of your car. I have cases every year where people decide they're going to get out of their car while they're waiting.
Want to go tell them something?
Yeah.
And well, see, when I grew up, if I got stopped as a teenager where I was growing up, I always got out of the car. Now, I was told never to do that, but I got out of the car because my dad would borrow my car, and he drank a lot. I didn't want beer in my car. I didn't want him coming to my car. So I'd get out of the car, we'd have a conversation, and I could go.
Exactly.
I had to keep him away.
Yes.
That's not a problem anymore.
No, but at the same time, one of the things that you should know is that an officer can't inspect your vehicle. They can see stuff that's in plain view, but they can't be going through and looking under the seats and doing anything else without your consent or without a court order. So
if they see a beer can or they see a weapon, then they can ask you to get out of the car.
They, as long as they have probable cause that there's some sort of crime that's been committed.
Okay,
yes.
Okay.
normally in your regular traffic stop, they're not going to have you get out.
Right.
And so that's why I'm saying don't presume that you're going to jail when they pull you over. It's just you could be getting a citation. Who knows?
If they do ask you out, it's because they might want to do a DUI test now.
That's right.
You can't do it inside the car.
That's exactly right. And then that's where they'll start they'll just ask you to get out of the car. And you can certainly ask why. And they should tell you because you're under investigation for a DUI.
Yeah.
Or I'd like to have you do some voluntary roadside maneuvers. Or I'd like to talk to you outside of the car because normally what they'll say is I have indicia that you may be under the influence of alcohol because they'll smell it or drugs.
Yeah. Yeah.
But mostly alcohol because they get the smell and then they look at your eyes, bloodshot, watery eyes. You're acting funky. Normally, a police officer that pulls you over for a traffic stop is not going to be what's called a drug recognition expert. So they're not going to be an individual that's specifically trained for recognizing when you're impaired by drugs.
Right.
Most of them will be your regular traffic officers. And you'll notice many times whenever there's a DUI stop, there's always two officers on the side of the road. It's because they have the second officer that's specifically trained.
If you're ever stopped, like getting a ticket, and then all of a sudden another car pulls up, there's probably a problem.
That's a bad sign.
That's a bad sign.
That's not a good sign.
I've ever had that happen.
Yeah, when you have another officer that appears, that's generally something's going on that's more significant. It's funny because I was driving out to Rocky Mountain Roosters one early morning. I think I've told you the story. We were driving out by the courthouse in Arapahoe County, and there were two cop cars right to the left of me, and the road went down to one lane, and I kind of cut because they were going slow. They weren't going the speed limit. They were going under the speed limit. And so I sort of sped up and moved over to get in front of them because I figured, well, they're going below the speed limit, so I can do that. And then sort of weaved around a little bit because I was making sure, because I had a buddy that was with me that was following me to make sure that they saw where we were going. And the cop pulled me over. And he basically came up to the door saying, you know, why'd you do that? And I explained why I did it. And he goes, well, you didn't put on your blinker. I said, yeah, I did put on my blinker, but okay. And so he went back and looked at my license and everything else. And I think because of the time of day, they had pulled me over because they thought I was under the influence of something. You know, I've got a dog box in the back, and shotguns, and box of donuts in the front seat. And so while I'm sitting there talking to the one guy, I see out of my rearview mirror another officer coming up on the passenger side of my vehicle, you know, pretty sneakily, but I saw him. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh boy, now what's going on?
Phase two.
But it turned out he came back and he just gave me a warning saying, hey, don't do that again. I'm like, okay, we'll go the speed limit. And I won't. And then they went off on their way. I did offer them a donut that I had, and they didn't accept it.
They did not accept it.
They were younger officers.
Oh, really.
But in those situations, you know, it's definitely something where you're talking about that second officer. If that happens, you've been there for a while, and another officer appears, you can assume that they think that they may have other probable cause to ask you to get out of the vehicle.
Okay, another question I have. And when I got my concealed carry, they kind of went through some of what I'm going to ask you about.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure it's correct. When there's an incident in your house, if you have a weapon, and you have to call 911 for whatever the outcome, what is things you should say, shouldn't say, do, don't do?
Yeah. So, all right. So, intruder in the house has come in the house, and have you used the gun on the intruder?
Yes.
All right. And you're now making the phone call, 911 call.
Yeah, there's somebody on my floor that...
Yep, is bleeding out, potentially. All right. So, what I recommend people to do is call 911, and when the dispatcher gets on, you tell them your name and address. You tell them that you were a victim of a home invasion, that there was an intruder in your home. You have fired your gun at the intruder, and the intruder needs immediate medical attention.
That's a lot to remember at that
time. It is. But the idea is that you're telling them where you are, who you are, and the fact that you were the victim of a crime, and that you defended yourself. However you want to say that. But you want to say it very short, in a brief period of time, because you are in the midst of a significant activity in your life in regards to what has gone on in your home. Now, you have lots of legal defenses, but when the police arrive, you are going to be a potential criminal, and there will be some investigation relating to it. So you want to say as little as possible to the dispatcher. You'll want they'll probably ask you what you look like, what you're wearing, whether or not there's other people in the home, and whether or not there's anyone else in danger. So those are the things that you will want to be prepared to talk about. And then you'll want to ask them if you want them to stay on the line while the until police gets there, or you can hang up. And you'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Can you hang up if they want you to stay on the line?
I would not hang up. Okay. I would stay on the line because that is going to be a something else that may come up later that you didn't follow instructions.
Okay.
Now, relating to this particular event that's happened, you'll also want to consider where the gun is and what you're and making sure that the other individuals in the house are protected from the police when they get to the house. Because at the point in which the police get there, they're going to be in a position where they're going to have guns drawn and they're going to not know exactly what's going on in the house. They're going to assume that everyone in the house
is in danger.
Is a danger.
Yeah.
And individuals who are in the house do not want to put them in a position where they may get shot. I mean, unfortunately,
there was a story a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Where a guy was trying to handle it and the cops saw him with it and they ended up shooting him.
Correct. Yeah, and my advice relating to the actual gun itself that you've used is you'll want to put that down near wherever you shot. Make sure that there's no issue that anybody's going to get to it and use it at the time so that when the police arrive, you don't have any guns in your your possession.
Don't walk out on the front porch holding your guns.
Right. That's exactly right.
Bad idea.
Bad idea. And whatever you tell them that you're wearing, you don't want to go change your clothes after you've told them what you're wearing. You want to keep your same clothes because there's going to be gun residue. There's going to be lots of things on
Don't go wash your hands.
Yeah, and don't do anything. Just, don't change the scene of the event because that's going to be something that they're going to investigate as well.
And then you don't probably want to they're going to want to know, okay, Scott, tell us what happened.
Yeah, tell us what happened. Yep. And so what you're going to be in shock. I mean, this is going to be a traumatic event for the shooter as well as the person that's been shot. But you, at that point, want to make sure that the police understand that you were the person that was victimized by what took place. You don't know who this person was. And then after that, you want to make sure that you don't make any further statements without having your lawyer present.
Yeah. Now, in this concealed carry, and we got into this conversation, if somebody's in my house and they're not a threat to me, they're not coming at me, they have my TV, for example, and they're walking out the front door, I can't shoot them.
You cannot shoot them. You cannot shoot them in the back, period.
No, you might hit your TV.
Yeah.
I can shoot at my TV, but I can't shoot them because they're not a threat to me.
Well, so the Castle Doctrine, that's what you're really talking about with regard to shooting someone in your home. The best practice is exactly that, that if they're not threatening you with any sort of force, you can't use lethal force. It's going to be the best defense for you. At the same time, there's a whole other line of discussion relating to the fact that if the person is in your house committing a crime, stealing your TV is committing a crime, that you have the right to use lethal force. I mean, that's also what the law says. But in the event that you shoot them, let's say, outside of your home as they're leaving with your TV and you shoot them in the back, you've lost that defense. And so, I mean, I never want to see people shooting other people, right? No matter what the circumstance. So even though you may have the legal right to do it in the home, if they're not currently a threat to you and you know that they're the only person that's in the house that could be a threat, I wouldn't be suggesting that you shoot first and ask questions later.
Take a picture of them on your phone.
Yeah.
Shoot them with your phone. I got a picture of you stealing my TV.
Right.
I mean, that's a lot to think about at the time.
It is.
Because they talked about that in
but
the class.
But the other thing I'm sure they talked about in your concealed carry class is put yourself, get yourself some training and get yourself in those situations.
Yes.
So that you have some mental memory and also some muscle memory as to what to do. I mean, that's, I can't stress that enough. Because all of us that have concealed carry permits, I'm hoping are out doing some training relating to it.
I was going to say, if you have one, you better be shooting it every now and then.
Mm-hmm. And in difficult situations, stressful situations.
Yeah, imagine, grab it.
Right.
You need to practice with it because it has to be second nature.
Because you've seen enough deals with cops and stuff where what appears to be a non-threatening situation can turn in about 1.5 seconds.
Exactly,
you know what I mean?
A blink of an eye.
Guy's walking TV, all of a sudden he hears a sound. You come downstairs, and then he turns.
Yeah.
He's got to go. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
You
so
have to
be
prepared for that,
right?
And it's hard.
And you know, there's the other training that's out there. I mean, the reason that you carry concealed is because you don't want people to know that you have the gun until you have to use it. And once you decide that you have to use it, then it's a point of no return, really.
Yeah. If you pull it out.
Yep. It means that you're using it.
Don't think that you just get to scare somebody with
it. Because that's menacing.
They're not afraid of that. They're afraid of the thing that comes out of it.
Correct. Well, you'd be surprised. I've done a number of menacing trials in the last 5 years, and our population, I would say half of the jurors a lot of times, I'll ask just that question. If you see a person with a handgun, because we're an open carry state.
Yes.
You see a person with a handgun, are you frightened by just seeing that handgun? And a lot of people will say yes. Mm-hmm. I'm frightened by the mere sight of that handgun on a person. And so you just waving it around, in most situations, somebody's going to call saying that there was a menacing going on. So completely agree that anytime we use a gun in public, you have to be prepared that you're going to be the one that's going to be asked questions and there may be some criminal charges that are brought. Now, very defendable. You know, I've had the majority of the menacing cases that I've gone to trial on, actually all of them in the last 5 years, the jury has acquitted the person. But they've had to go through that brain damage to get to the point there. You have individuals that, you know, the road rage situation where you pull out the gun to settle down the situation. Anything with regard to protecting yourself, in any jury selection or any opening or closing arguments, I'm always talking about our right to bear arms and our right to protect ourselves and making sure that you get the right jurors.
Well, that makes me think of that guy that went after us. He found his truck and he was going to go get his truck. He chased to where it was and he went up and there was a 12-year-old driving it. He took his gun with him. Some people say, well, that was the wrong thing to do. Well, the 12-year-old had a gun.
Yeah.
How do you know?
Yeah. I've got a case right now where an individual, his uncle, had his truck stolen out in Aurora and about a month prior. And the month at the time of this event that happened, he saw the truck a month later and said, hey, that's my uncle's truck. And so he started following it. The person got onto C-470, was driving like 90 miles an hour. He was chasing him. The guy went around some traffic, hit one of the bridge pilings, rolled the car, and two people in the car, the people that were the thieves, both died. And now my client's charged with reckless driving because he was chasing the thief. What do you think of that?
Man. Whoa.
Because our police officers don't, and they called the police, said where the truck was, and the police were like, well, we can't get to it right now. And so they've...
He's just, like, I can.
Yeah.
But well, that's that, another that sounds, show by itself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
With what...
But that's an interesting in our... So it's going to be a really interesting case because my client didn't cause the accident. He was just following him in a fast manner.
Write him a ticket.
Right. And he is. But, I mean, the ticket is up to a year in jail, in county jail.
Yeah. For driving fast, that's part of it. But being accused of killing these...
Well, and it's they're saying that one of the allegations is because he was following him that the other driver...
He caused it.
That he caused the death.
No.
You know, but that's... I mean, that's our system. I mean, that's
our system. Where's the blame?
The blend of, where's the blame game going to end up? And that's going to be an interesting argument with the district attorney because the district attorneys would normally say, well, that's police's role. Yeah, I get it, but the police have... The police get the power from us, right? The common citizens. I mean, we're allowing them to do the police work because we don't necessarily want to do it, and we're giving them the opportunity to do those things. I mean, that power doesn't come from anywhere else but the citizenry. Well, how far do you go with the citizen's arrest? And I've litigated those cases over the years, too, and those are interesting cases as well. And, you know, and it depends on whether it's downtown Denver or the mountains in Jefferson County, because those two jury panels will have different opinions and views on what. Yeah. And it comes back to the concealed carry, too. You know, in downtown urban areas, is concealed carry okay, or is it more prevalent in the outlying parts of Colorado? It's a super interesting dichotomy, I think, because probably the use of concealed carry would be better served in the urban areas to protect you. But I think the majority of the people that would say they have a concealed carry permit are out in the outlying areas, mm-hmm. where probably it's not as needed.
That goes to that guy in Arvada that concealed yeah. carry came out. He helped the situation, yep. did the right thing.
And then picked up the gun.
But then picked up the wrong
yeah.
weapon.
Yeah, and got shot.
And the cop didn't know.
He didn't know. I know. And that's that claim is an interesting one, too, because I think his estate is now suing the city of Arvada and whether or not the officer acted appropriately. And I don't know what the answer is.
Right.
Because
we don't know the facts.
Right. Because from the police officer's standpoint.
There was a guy with a gun.
Yeah, he had no idea.
Right. He had no yeah. idea. Sure. And it's the same thing that how this question started, and my answer back to the house is you want to make sure, again, similar to our traffic situation, make sure that those officers are making good decisions and aren't making decisions related to fear, anxiety, or something else that's stressing them out. Super interesting.
And, you know, real quick, last couple of minutes here for today's show, and we'll definitely do this again, hopefully.
Oh, without
with Kevin,
a doubt.
Okay.
But, way too much fun.
Colorado
I got lots
ranks
more questions.
Number one in, you know, auto theft, and second, I read this morning, in property crime. So just keep what we're saying in mind. If you see someone out in the middle of the night, you know, breaking in your car, you know, stealing your car or rummaging through your car, breaking through the car, you can't walk out there with a gun there
right.
in your driveway.
Yeah.
It's a car.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, and I think the legal theory behind that is, you know, you bring similar, so the self-defense argument is relating to bringing like force to the force that you've got against you, right? And somebody who's stealing your stereo out of your car, you shouldn't be able to use lethal force against that property crime. Right. And that's the idea. I mean, certainly if somebody pulls a knife, you have the right to pull a gun and defend yourself, because a knife is lethal force. But if someone's threatening you, you don't have the right to shoot them unless they're threatening you with lethal force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you could see, not yeah. just verbs.
And it's a little bit, right. I mean, it's a little bit different in your house, because that we all legally understand that you have the right to defend yourself in your house. And that's where we were yes. talking about initially. But if the person is running out your front door, you can't shoot them in your front yard because they're no
right.
longer in your house.
Yeah, you can't shoot them in the back.
You can't shoot them in the back because that looks, I mean, I think any juror would look at that and say, well, wait a second.
Where's the threat?
Yeah, exactly.
He didn't have a weapon.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
No weapon, and there's nothing to indicate that they aren't leaving. There is this thought that you have to retreat sometimes relating to a perceived threat.
And that's hard to do.
In your home, you don't have to do that, mm-hmm. but also you don't use lethal force if there's no reason to.
Sure. Yeah. Attorney Kevin Flesh, it is Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886. Hey, always a free initial consultation on any legal matter with Kevin. And once again, you can catch Kevin here on Thursdays, noon to 12:30 here on KLZ, and Saturdays, 10:30 to 11 for Legal Talk on our sister station, 810-95.3. So, Kevin, as always, thank you very much. We'll see you Thursday.
Thank you.
Kurt, thank you as well.
Thanks, Kurt.
Thanks for being with us today for our special edition of Legal Talk, brought to you by Affordable Interest Mortgage. 720-895-0500 for Kurt. Thanks for being with us. Hope you have a great rest of your day.